Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour is Colin Woodard. Well, if you don't know his name, you've probably seen his map of North America. In 2011, his New York Times bestselling book, American Nations, in that book, Woodard proposed a framework for examining American history and current events based on a view of our country, not as a collection of states, but as a federation of 11 nations. You can do an image search for American nations, and you'll see this alternative picture of the people of North America. Each nation is defined by a shared culture established by each nation's founding population. Now, the nations were given names based on these shared cultures, names such as Yankeedom, Deep South, Greater Appalachia, New France, Far West, and Midlands. That's us, a nation that includes most of Iowa. Now, the people of the Midlands, it was described, are German-dominated, open-minded, and less inclined toward activist government than, say, Yankeedom. Well, in his latest book, titled Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood, Colin Woodard asks the next question: when and how did we come to convince ourselves that we were one nation with a shared past, purpose, and future? Colin Woodard joins me again on the program. So great to have you back on, Colin.
It's wonderful to be back. Thank you for having me.
In describing this book, you write, it's the story of how the peoples of the United States answered these great existential questions of nationhood. Where did we come from? Who are we? Where are we going? So, Colin, tell us more to start off about how the idea for this book sprang from your 2011 book, American Nations.
Right. Well, as you described very well, American Nations was telling the story of how we've never been one America, but several Americas. Each of these regional cultures reaching back to the differences between the various colonial projects that formed in the, you know, eastern and southern rims of what's now the United States, projects that were Dutch and Spanish and French, and even the English ones were entirely different from one another, whether you were in New England or in the Chesapeake Country or in the Lowland South or the Appalachian Backcountry. And that if you know the map of how these various colonial areas settled. They sort of settled these mutually exclusive bands of the country, and a lot of their fundamental values very different from one another, different ethnographically and religiously and socially and in terms of the kind of society they were trying to create, you can see those things reflected on today's county-level election maps, in dialect maps, in polling, in all sorts of things. So that led me, of course, to wonder, well, at what point did we convince ourselves this was not the case? At what point did we obscure that fundamental definitional aspect of our federation? When did the story of a United States nationhood, of us being a unitary nation with its own shared history going back into the past, when was that myth created? And by who? And for what purpose? And did it work? And are there any lessons in it that we could have today, right? Because we're living at a time when people are again wondering what holds us together. We have these red states and blue. We have MAGA and Black Lives Matter and fundamental disagreements over values and who really can be an American or should be an American and over monuments and flags from our past. You know, it's spilled out into the streets. This is a really poignant moment. But when I was approaching writing Union, that was the question I had, is where did this all come from? And what I discovered was that there really weren't any answers as to what the United States was until the 1830s. You know, when what these different regional cultures and what the different colonies had in common was a shared threat in the 1770s from the British Empire that led them to end up in a military alliance with one another and fight a revolution. And then suddenly they found themselves in this federation, this thing called the United States, and no one was really sure what it was.
Right.
European Union-like federation, or what was it?
Right. And that's fascinating. This is the way you open the book. Before we get into the mid-1800s and beyond, the way you open the book is with the battle in the American Revolution that led to the surrender of the British military under Lord Cornwallis. And you write at the start, nobody really knew what this United States was or what it should become, or even if it should continue to exist at all. And this is really fascinating because we live at a time when the United States of America is nearly 250 years old since the Declaration of Independence. But take us back to the mindset that must have existed over 200 years ago in U.S. history. How was the U.S. thought of in the years immediately following the American Revolution? How did citizens think of this collection of former colonies?
Right. Well, if you'd asked people what country they're from in the early republic, people would have said, oh, I'm a Massachusettsian, I'm a South Carolinian, right? I'm a Kentuckian. Nobody would have said, except, you know, that they were an American, except the way that a German or an English person might say, I'm a European, right? It was the United States itself was still this abstract idea. And the way people thought about it was many people were very proud that the country had achieved its independence, that these various colonies had defended each of their self-government and idiosyncratic ways of governing themselves and their culture from a British attempt to impose conformity and central rule from London. And they were proud of this incredible accomplishment, and the initial way that people thought about it, the United States, was as a celebration of a shared victory in an existential crisis. And the reason that by the 1830s that started being unsatisfying is that the revolutionary generation was dying off. There was no one around with a living memory of that struggle to have that much invested in it. And at the same time, we'd had these secessionist movements, these centripetal forces that were at work between the regional cultures had resulted in portions of Greater Appalachia trying to secede from the United States in the 1790s and the Whiskey Rebellion, in New England senior statesmen considering seceding from the United States in 1814 during the War of 1812. There was this definite sense that this vacuum, this lack of definition as to what the United States was becoming a fundamental national security threat, and that we needed answers. We needed a story as to why these disparate regions with so many things not in common should stick together and what our purpose might be in doing so.
Mm-hmm. And is this where the idea of federalism comes in, and why I think you say in the book that federalism at this point, because of what you just described, was unavoidable?
Yeah, prior to the creation of a story of United States nationhood, the various colonies and now states were trying to figure out how they would collectively govern, and they didn't trust each other, right? They had been rivals and often enemies in the colonial period. Many of the colonies ended up on opposite sides of key struggles like the English Civil War or the Glorious Revolution of 1689, which is a huge event in the English imperial world. And not trusting one another, they had to create a form of government, a constitutional structure that could sort of allow any one region to veto the others, so that no one region had to worry that they were going to be forced into doing things they didn't want to do, which is why you have federalism and also these complex separation of power and different ways to check power at a regional level, as well as the initial effort to sort of check the common people from having too much influence in the government, because it wasn't felt that they would make good decisions.
Right.
So these things led to our constitutional structure being the way it is.
Right. And not to jump to too quickly forward, but for instance, this explains why we have a Senate the way it is. For instance, Wyoming, I don't know how many, couple million people, maybe 1-2 million people in Wyoming, has the same number.
500,000 people, even, actually.
Oh, my goodness. 500,000 people in Wyoming. They have two senators just like California with tens of millions.
33 million or something, yeah.
And this all traces back to this time you're just describing, right?
Yes. I mean, because the Senate, the different forms of government, the Senate was an aristocratic chamber originally. The senators weren't elected by the people. They were chosen by the state legislatures. presumed to be from their own, so that you would have, you know, the best people, the sort of proper educated types would be in the Senate. You had the House, which was Democratic and you more reflected the general population's preferences, and you had a presidency which was sort of monarchical in many senses and was also chosen not by the people but by electors. And in many states, the electors weren't chosen by popular election but rather by the legislators. And then you had an almost priestly caste in the form of the Supreme Court, who would pore over our sacred texts and, you know, had lifetime appointments and would make these fundamental decisions about the law. So, yeah, you had a peculiar system with all sorts of checks, both between the classes in society, but also in the structure of the Senate between the regions, to ensure that the smaller states, particularly ones where the enslaved part of the population wasn't allowed to vote, would not be vetoed or forced into anything they didn't want by the larger ones.
If you just joined us, my guest this hour is Colin Woodard, New York Times bestselling writer. He's a historian, journalist who has reported from more than 50 foreign countries. Union is his latest book, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. Let's get to the sort of crux of this new book, Colin. It centers on five men that you've selected. At the start of your book, you write, "What I discovered in the course of my research was an intellectual battle of the highest possible stakes that spanned a century and ultimately helped explain a great deal about the age in which we now live." And you examine how the myth of our national unity was created, fought over by five men. Now, a couple of these are household names, others less well known: George Bancroft, William Gilmore Sims, Frederick Douglass, Woodrow Wilson, and also Frederick Jackson Turner. Tell us why you selected these five men for this story.
I was trying to find who were, you know, the key figures through which you could write the story almost biographically, almost like a novel, where you'd have actual people and scenes and character and action, because I believed it would be the best way to tell the story. Because it's not just that an intellectual idea was put forward and had effects on real life, it's that particular individuals with certain experiences and background and friends and enemies came up with these different stories, and it lets you understand much better why they came forward and the milieu they were from and the struggle that was taking place and what the country was like at the time. And so I felt that that was the best way you could tell the story. And then that required that you figure out and isolate who were, if you were to have a handful of figures who were the key prominent figures who fought the battle and who represented most compellingly in both their influence and the weight of their ideas, the competing philosophies at work, who would they be? And that required just doing massive amounts of reading about how the story of our nationhood was created and who fought over it, and looking at all sorts of different people to finally isolate the ones that could together adequately and compellingly and accurately tell the story of how this all played out over a century. Mm-hmm. And so these individuals all met that mark. George Bancroft was very clearly the person who first packaged an idea and a story of United States nationhood. He was a— do you want me to go into him now?
Let's start off with the first two you describe as intellectual rivals: George Bancroft, representing this sort of civic nationalism, and William Gilmore Sims, what you term the Anglo-Saxon ethnostate, because they really have such relevance for our current time. Talk about the first two there, because you juxtapose them in the first 100, 150 pages of your book.
Right, because they were promptly in the 1830s two competing stories. One recognized that because we don't share a past or an ethnography or a unique language, that we shared a future, and that what held us together was this shared commitment to a set of ideals in the Declaration of Independence: the innate equality of humans everywhere, the unalienable rights each should enjoy, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and the promise of self-government. And to be truly American was to share and defend those values. These, you know, these were ideals, maybe not in practice, but they, in theory, would apply to everyone. And that idea that the United States was special and that it had been tasked to do this, tasked, in fact, by God in its original form, was put forth by a man named George Bancroft. And George Bancroft was he's not so well known today, but he was the most celebrated historian and statesman of much of the 19th century. He was very much a New Englander. He was, you know, the descendant of early Puritans. His father was a very prominent Congregational minister. He attended Phillips Exeter Academy in Harvard, was sent to study in Germany, and came back to eventually write through a series of histories, a 10-volume history of the United States, the first real history that had been that anyone had attempted to produce of the country at large, as opposed to its individual states. He articulated this vision, and he articulated almost in sort of Puritan New England terms, right? That if the early Puritans thought they were chosen by God to create a, you know, have an errand in the wilderness and put a light on a hill and create a more godly society, George Bancroft believed that Americans had been tasked by providence and history and God himself to carry the torch of human freedom forward through the ideals and the Declaration of Independence. We were a chosen people, that God was perhaps at work among the founders when they were creating our founding documents, that our destiny was to do these things. And all of that stuff, American exceptionalism, all these ideas, which you will sense the echoes of in the way that people talk about America and have talked about it ever since, originated or were first properly packaged and put forward and disseminated to everyone in these blockbuster histories that took him, you know, 70 years to write all 10 volumes of. But each one that came out was a riveting cultural moment at a time when speeches and books and pamphlets were the way people communicated. Somebody would give a speech, it would be published in a newspaper, and then other newspapers would get a copy of it and, you know, retweet it, so to speak. They would publish it. That's how ideas got around and were fought over, and he was at the center of those things. And not only those things, but he served as a statesman. He served as Secretary of War and Secretary of the Navy under the Polk administration, and played a key role in furthering our manifest destiny and key roles in issuing orders which led to the war in Mexico and the annexation of California, and later served as ambassador to London and to Berlin, gave the official eulogy for Andrew Jackson before Congress and of Abraham Lincoln. I mean, he was a huge figure, and his influence was profound.
Mm-hmm. So but juxtapose, juxtapose Bancroft, as you do in the book, with William Gilmore Sims. This is a pro-slavery Southern writer, a contemporary of Bancroft, who has a much different view of what our Union is about.
William Gilmore Sims, like Bancroft, is forgotten today, but he was also a huge figure in the early 19th century. He was the antebellum South's and the Confederacy's leading man of letters. He was a best-selling novelist whose books were hits in all across the United States. And he came forward almost immediately with this counter vision to Bancroft's civic nationalism. He said no, that Jefferson was wrong when he wrote the Declaration of Independence, that all people are clearly not created equal, that some are not capable of self-government and of living in a republic. In fact, that only the Anglo-Saxon race, allegedly superior and gifted, had all of the talents and the wherewithal to govern themselves, and that the United States was a collection of organic nations, of South Carolina as a nation and Georgia and Massachusetts, but what they all shared was that they were homelands of the superior Anglo-Saxon race. So it was a story of ethno-nationalism and an ethnic identity and what we would today call white supremacy, a story that evolved from just the Anglo-Saxons to include other segments, you know, white Christians or white Protestants first and white Christians later and so on, but the central idea being that only some people truly belong and can truly be Americans, and that we're not all inherently equal. And that battle was joined, you know, we actually fought a civil war over it, with the ideas of Bancroft and Sims actually clashing in many of the arguments and things that led up to the war itself.
Mm-hmm. Of course, white supremacy, thought of in a certain way today, was white supremacy, it seems like it was much more accepted at this time as a legitimate point of view.
Well, I mean, racism, casual racism of the sort that we would find today rather stunning, existed across the different regions. But on some level, there was a notion in New England and the North that these ideals probably applied to everyone, even if we didn't really want to do it that way. You know, legally speaking, people might have voting rights and such. You might discriminate against them in all sorts of ways. But there was a big gap between that and the South that William Gilmore Sims lived in, where other races had no political rights and where most people were enslaved and had no civic rights and were considered less than human under the law as well as in practice. So there was this big gap there as well that that made these national stories have different levels of popularity depending on what region of the country you're in, and very much more so as the 1850s unfolded and we became closer to a civil war, fundamentally over slavery and ideas of human equality or not.
Mm-hmm. How did the ideas of, say, William Gilmore Sims square with the idea of equality at that time? We have in our Declaration of Independence that key phrase, all men are created equal. Yet our nation was founded on slavery and the ideas of, written about by Sims and so forth. So how did the people of that time square those two things?
Well, in two ways. In one, William Gilmore Sims and his intellectual colleagues, people like James Henry Hammond and others, explicitly attacked those words in the Declaration of Independence. They wrote that Jefferson was wrong and clearly, that should be revised and that's not what's meant and was not true. So they didn't accept it to begin with, but the way they squared living in a supposedly democratic republic with slavery and inequity is South Carolina and much of the lowland deep South, their model was classical republicanism. In other words, ancient Greece and Rome, which were slave societies where the majority of people lived in bondage or servitude and that was considered just fine, and a minority had the privilege of practicing, the liberty of practicing democracy, which is how ancient Greece and Rome worked. And so they created the same model with illusions and architecture and the like that led back to the ancient world. And that was perfectly fine. You would have a slave-holding republic, and in fact, only in that way could it be stable because they believed that ordinary people couldn't be trusted to make great decisions of state and therefore needed to be kept far away from the levers of power. And so, yeah, there were two ways in which it was done. And that only illustrates just how profound the differences were between the regions that somehow had to be papered over to make the United States possible.
Let's talk about another figure. You focus on one of these five men, known to most of us, Frederick Douglass, an American social reformer in the 1800s. After escaping from slavery in Maryland, he became a national leader of the abolitionist movement. How does he figure into this story you're telling in Union of our nationhood? Why did you select Frederick Douglass? Tell us more about how he shaped it.
Because Douglass becomes the pivotal figure in the creation of our nationhood. Because while George Bancroft articulated these ideals, Bancroft's position was that we were destined for these things, that God had already chosen our country.
After a short break, we'll return to my conversation with journalist and historian Colin Woodard. His new book is titled Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel, in mind now, and in person soon.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Just a reminder that if you catch only part of a conversation on one of our talk shows and want to hear the whole thing, or if you think someone else would enjoy a conversation you hear on one of our talk shows, remember, audio podcasts of all of our shows can be found at iowapublicradio.org. And we usually get those posted to our website within 24 hours of the original broadcast. Again, for podcasts, audio podcasts to listen to again or to share with someone else, simply look for River to River at iowapublicradio.org. This hour, my recent conversation with New York Times bestselling writer, historian, and journalist Colin Woodard. Colin is a reporter at Maine's Portland Press Herald. He's the author of six books, including American Nations,
a history of the 11 rival regional cultures of North America. It was really this work from 2011 that gained him wide acclaim. The idea behind that work is that North America is made up of 11 distinct nations, each with its own unique historical roots. So this hour, we're talking about his latest book titled Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. And in this one, in this book, Colin Woodard asks the question, when and how did we come to convince ourselves that we were one nation with a shared past, purpose, and future? He writes, "What I discovered in the course of my research was an intellectual battle of the highest possible stakes that spanned a century and ultimately helped explain a great deal about the age in which we now live. It was a battle, as we talked about in the first half, between civic and ethnocentric nationalism." He writes about how the myth of our national unity was created and fought over by five men. Those men, George Bancroft, William Gilmore Sims, Frederick Douglass, Woodrow Wilson, and Frederick Jackson Turner. So at this point in our conversation, I asked about how one of these men, Frederick Douglass, factored into creating this sense of nationhood in the United States.
That we were therefore on some level infallible, and that history had a plan, and we must all just sit back patiently and watch it unfold. In other words, he was unwilling to admit that the ideals that the country was supposedly founded on had not been met. And he was very stubborn in this view through his long life. He lived until the early 1890s, so he saw the Civil War and Reconstruction and the Klan's reign of terror during the redemption of the Southern governments. And it made no impression upon him. But Frederick Douglass is the one who took that vision of what our country should be and used his incredible oratorical power, his international celebrity, and his very powerful writings to point out that America had not achieved its ideals and that it must do so, and that it was betraying them, and that America was still a work in progress. And he was able to bring his influence to the White House, to Abraham Lincoln on multiple occasions, and push him to close the gap between his the rhetoric of American nationhood and its practices, probably playing a role in pushing him towards the Gettysburg Address, where Lincoln finally steps out and reasserts that this defense of this civic national vision is what the sacrifices of the Civil War are about. And he carried on through, the lonely struggle through the end of Reconstruction and essentially the restoration of white supremacy and white supremacist government throughout the South and the acquiescence in that. He was the voice fighting against it and placing it in the public square and spotlighting it over and over again through his career. And in the process, wrote some of the most compelling speeches and descriptions of what our civic national tradition is and what the United States should be that have ever been put together. So he was a very powerful and important figure in furthering that vision, even when that vision's primary earlier author was essentially betraying it and not following through in a sort of hypocritic way. I mean, George Bancroft would never even recognize Frederick Douglass's existence in any of his writings, even though Douglass was this massive figure.
Huh.
Yeah, Bancroft was ambassador to London while Frederick Douglass was touring England and Scotland to enormous crowds. He was a huge celebrity in Great Britain, and not once does Bancroft comment on this at all, even though the man is arguing for the very ideals set forth in Bancroft's history.
Hmm. Colin Woodard is my guest. His new book, Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. One of the five men, I guess it's really surprising to think about how we think about Woodrow Wilson, one of these five men today. This is a former president of, Princeton, former governor of New Jersey before becoming our 28th U.S. president in the early 20th century. But here we have Woodrow Wilson as an unabashed white supremacist. This really recasts this man who initiated the League of Nations. We think of much differently today. So how does he fit into this story?
Yeah, it was shocking to me just how blatant and obvious Woodrow Wilson's white supremacist views, how extreme they were and upfront they were throughout his life. And the fact that this somehow has gotten swept under the rug of history, I find absolutely mind-blowing. He was raised in the Deep South. His father was the leading light of the Confederate Presbyterian Church, a man who wrote a famous and widely disseminated pamphlet called Slavery Ordained by God, which made that very argument. And Woodrow Wilson looked up to him his entire life. And Wilson was a very much a white supremacist, and wrote in his histories the argument that many races, among them African Americans, just did not have the capabilities to be free people, and that the effort of African Americans to participate in politics during Reconstruction was a terrible failure for this reason, that the Ku Klux Klan were heroes and didn't hurt anybody. I mean, it was a staggering things to be putting into his history texts, which were enormously popular in the 1890s and early 1900s, and no obstacle at all to him becoming president of Princeton. And when he finally got to the White House, he indeed, you know, remember, he's the first Southern-born president since the Civil War to be enter the White House. And what he does is segregates the federal government, the Postal Service, and, you know, military units and the like. The Union itself had, you know, they say the South lost the war but won the peace. The peace is won when Woodrow Wilson ascends to the White House. There were, it was commented on at his inauguration, all the people doing rebel yells and overwhelming numbers of Southerners in his cabinet. And then the first blockbuster Hollywood film ever, The Birth of a Nation, a film which glorified the Ku Klux Klan's campaign of terror against African Americans in the Reconstruction South. That film was based on a novel by Thomas Dixon Jr., and Thomas Dixon Jr. was one of Woodrow Wilson's best buddies and graduate school classmates. And when the film was threatened, because African Americans and their allies across the country picketed and protested the film outside movie theaters when it was going to screen, this at a time when the First Amendment hadn't yet been held to protect artistic expression, and cities and states regularly censored theater and film productions that were thought to be not in the public interest. So there was enormous threat to the film that various cities would ban the film, and that's what the protesters were demanding. Well, Woodrow Wilson screened the film for Dixon in the White House to his cabinet, and then the next day the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court did the same for the Supreme Court justices and for leaders of Congress, because the Chief Justice had been a member of the Klan. I mean, this is where the country was at. There was a consensus view after the Civil War, culminating in Wilson's election, that what, you know, we had this shared that whites on both sides could forget about the moral content of the war, that we all had fought for noble purposes, and that we would all hold hands and agree on what boiled down to this sort of ethno-national point of view, this white Anglo-Saxon Protestant dominant perspective that was encoded in things like the 1924 Immigration Act and so on. So there's a times in our history where this ethno-national view has in fact been the dominant and consensus view for decades. And, you know, it hasn't been entirely vanquished today. It's been with us since the beginning, and it's been a very powerful, not just some sideline force and not some force that only was prevalent in one region or another of the country at different times.
After you pointed out in your book that Woodrow Wilson screened The Birth of a Nation, this infamous celebration of white supremacy and the KKK at the White House, I took a look on YouTube at some of this. This is really shocking stuff. The scene that I saw was, some sort of a chamber, maybe the Senate, a chamber full of, I guess they were men in blackface.
Yeah, South Carolina State House at a time when South Carolina had a black majority, and when African Americans were allowed to vote, they of course sent a large number of African American legislators. So that's depicting the South Carolina State House after everyone is able to vote on who's going to be there.
And the blacks depicted there have their shoes off, feet up on the desks, they're drinking, and this is amazing.
One is eating a leg of fried chicken. I mean,
yes.
It's outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
And this takes the events that this is supposedly based on. Woodrow Wilson was living in South Carolina's capital when this all happened, about two blocks from the State House. And yet, you know, he celebrates this film, and indeed, his history of the United States, Wilson's history, there are placards within the film, if you watch the film, the silent film, there are various placards with quotes from Woodrow Wilson's history, before he was even elected president, that enforce all of these white supremacist ideas that are being unfolded and championed in the film.
Mm-hmm. Before we're running out of time, before we get to the relevance of your book for today, I wanted to have you quickly pivot to the remaining figure we haven't talked about. Briefly talk about Frederick Jackson Turner. This is a man known for something called the Frontier Thesis.
Yeah, he was perhaps the most influential early 20th century historian. And unlike all these other people, he was from the West, the Midwest. He was raised in Wisconsin and was a professor at the University of Wisconsin. And his most famous contribution was the idea that what made Americans Americans was when they crossed over and started settling the Midwest and the Far West in frontier-like conditions. And that supposedly that environment, far from the contagions of Europe and its history and its legacy, that they were in sort of a new Garden of Eden and left to their own devices, became perfect model Republicans, you know, self-sufficient and respectful of each other and imbued with democracy and a can-do spirit. And so that has had an enormous role in the way that Americans have thought of themselves and a huge role for the next 50 years into the middle of the 20th century. The problem was that Frederick Jackson Turner himself, who was he loved research, but hated writing. He procrastinated as much as he could. He spent most of the rest of his career, even as his Frontier Thesis became this massive hit and enormously influential, he realized in his research that it wasn't accurate. He realized that the separate settlement streams from New England, from, you know, Pennsylvania, from Appalachia and so on, when they entered this new environment, the people persistently behaved differently. They didn't seem to be evolving, you know, to adapt to this new environment, but rather that their cultural experiences were holding on. In other words, he was groping towards kind of what I wrote about in American Nations. But because he was such a procrastinator, he filled boxes and boxes with notes, but never really finished his magnum opus on American sections. So that was the other key figure who tried to carry forward a civic national view instead of, you know, God having tasked America with something that the scientific, evolution had shaped the country.
Finishing up my conversation with Colin Woodard, a New York Times bestselling writer of American Nations, a historian, a journalist, and his new book, Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood, examining the myth of how our nation unity, national unity, was created. Now, perhaps the most exciting, at least for me, to get to the point after all this historical context, to have you talk a little bit about where we are today in this narrative that explains how our nation holds itself together after this foundation, this historical foundation, has been laid. What relevance does this story of our nationhood have for this moment?
I think enormous relevance, because I think we're sort of in an existential crisis as a nation. You know, people are wondering what indeed holds us together still. If we have these strong political differences and they also map to strong geographic differences, how do we survive? How do we find common ground? Is there anything that everyone will agree upon anymore? And one of the ways to think about that is to look back in our past and see what did hold us together successfully in the past. And that civic national tradition is what our history and what our past has given us as some of the ingredients through which we might build a new answer to those questions. The experience of humans, you know, that to have a sense of belonging in something as abstract as a nation, you mm-hmm. tend to have to draw back on tradition and symbols and things that have meaning from the past for legitimacy, even if you're trying to modify and update and refresh your argument. And understanding the story of how our civic national tradition was created, that we're what holds us together is these fealty, these ideals, and what they are, I think is enormously important first step to being able to to re-articulate a story of our shared purpose and our belonging and our past and what we're going towards in the future. Mm-hmm. And those are things that I think are of enormous importance for us as Americans if our Federation is indeed going to survive, you know, another 200 years or even another 20.
So, which leads me to my next question. What are the future scenarios we face as a union, as a nation? Where could we go? I mean, you're a historian, but if you project these lines into the future, do you see different paths we might take based on the forces at work at this moment?
I mean, when I was an undergraduate, I was majoring in East European and Balkan history. And then I was an exchange student in 1989 in Budapest when communism collapsed. And I spent my 20s and most of the 1990s covering what happened next, the rise of nationalisms, of ethnic conflict, of the collapse of federations like Yugoslavia, or more peacefully Czechoslovakia, or Russia itself. So, you know, my view and understanding of history more broadly, including other parts of the world, doesn't paint a super optimistic view of the human condition. Some of the possibilities of what can go wrong are, you know, dissolution into, rival, you know, countries and regions that are plotting against each other and are forming international alliances or alliances with each other and creating a much more unstable North America and therefore a more unstable world. You can also have situations where somehow the dissolution doesn't go peacefully and you end up in situations of civil war. But hopefully or you can end up in a situation where there's a intentional devolution of power towards something where the different states and component regions have more powers to themselves as a reallocation of the emphasis of federalism from the center to the periphery, creating more of a European Union, you know, with a weaker center than we have. Or somehow we continue with the American experiment, as a unified entity, but under a renewed sense and purpose. And I think the only way with our particular history and story is to renew that civic purpose of being committed to these ideals, because it's been shown by history to inspire not only many Americans, but to have been an inspirational symbol to people all around the world that made, you know, America that sort of place that people aspired to want to move to and that they saw as an expression of sort of human freedom universally. And I think that's something that's very much been lost in recent decades and certainly in the past few years, all of those things. But they're powerful things. So those are all the different possibilities. I would think the latter one would be more desirable in many ways than some of the others and perhaps fraught with fewer dangers.
Right. And the big question, I know we're running out of time here, but very quickly to put a name on it, Donald Trump, in reading this book and in researching it, you see he has very deep roots in history, this ethnic nationalism, right? He's tapping into something very powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. He's tapping into a tradition that goes back as far as our civic national tradition, which is why it's so powerful and can propel someone forward in the way it's propelled Donald Trump forward. And it's very much the same thing, you know, I saw in Yugoslavia with, you know, the rise of Milosevic and in, you know, other countries where these things have happened. It's not, it's a common experience in many, many countries, and it rarely ends up very well for the country or its people. So it's my experience in the Balkans and Eastern Europe definitely is a lens through which I've been watching events of the past decade in the United States, and it's definitely a worrisome thing.
Mm-hmm. Before you go, tell us the main thing you want readers to take away from this new book, Union.
That there have been the ethno-national and the civic national traditions and legacy both go deep back into our cultural DNA as a country, and that only one of them, the civic national one, is, you know, passes muster morally, but also as in any practical way could allow for a rejuvenated United States, and that we must understand and look back in the lessons and the mistakes that were made in how civic nationalism was executed and its unfulfilled promise, and to rejuvenate that and articulate a renewed sense of purpose going forward to the commitment to those values. Because otherwise it's difficult to see how the United States in the medium and long term will continue to exist in anything near its present form.
Colin Woodard, his latest book, Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. Colin Woodard, what a pleasure to speak with you again on this program. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that does it for today. Just a reminder that River to River is also available as a podcast. Simply go to iowapublicradio.org, or you can download our IPR app. River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Matt Alvarez, and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.